You are listening to the podcast of the Matyas Corvinus Collegium, the largest talent management institute in Hungary. If you want to know more about our mission, please look up our English website at mcc.hu/en or check out our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter channels. For interesting articles and analysis of our professors, external contributors, and students, look up our knowledge base at corvinus.hu/en.
Welcome to MCC Podcast. My name is Peter Heltai, and as the host of this program, I'm very happy to announce our first but not last episode in a foreign language, which is a significant step for us in the history of this channel, because English, and with this mixed metaphor, I will probably lose all our listeners from the British Isles, as the lingua franca of our times is not only necessary, but a must for those who want to participate in international relevant intellectual discussions and debates. And we are proud to open this series of podcasts with a very special guest, Julius Strauss, who had a fascinating career as a journalist and war zone correspondent. He reported from the Serbo-Croat and Bosnian wars and later became the Telegraph's Balkans correspondent. After covering Central Europe and the Balkans for years, he traveled, among others, to Sierra Leone, Afghanistan during the 9/11 period, and Iraq. Later, he was appointed the Telegraph's correspondent to Moscow. He saw with his eyes the Beslan school siege in 2004, and not much later he announced and with an unexpected turn traveled to British Columbia to open a grizzly bear ranch. Since then he has been giving tours for small groups among the frosty but beautiful mountains in Canada and have taken part in political campaigns against bear hunting. Moreover, his father is of Hungarian origin and he spent several years in Budapest. He is now back to Hungary for a few months and gives lectures at MCC's media school.
Okay, so Julius, it's a pleasure. Thanks for joining me today. Welcome to MCC Podcast. You have like a quite an impressive list of places where you covered mainly conflicts or where you have been to in war zones as first as a freelancer in the Balkans. So maybe just to start off, how did you get there? Why were you there? Why you decided to start writing or report from the Balkans in the 90s, I think?
In the very early 90s, yeah. I was actually in Budapest, and I was working here. I had just finished my university in London, and randomly I got a job here. It wasn't a very interesting job, and it didn't last very long, but I did have a job here with a foreign PR company. It only lasted a few months. And while I was in Budapest, the war broke out between the Serbs and the Croats. So there were lots of wars during the disintegration of Yugoslavia. The one that had come before was the Slovenian War, which was fairly short, and I wasn't at all involved in that. But then the war broke out between the Serbs and the Croats, and it was just unfathomable for me, I suppose partly because of my background, partly because I was European, but the notion that there's a war in Europe, which there hadn't really been since the Second World War. And it was only, 200 kilometers away from where I was sitting. And I found it intriguing, but also scary and also just extremely unlikely somehow. It didn't fit into my view of the world. So eventually I literally got in a car and just drove down. And that started as sort of a pattern. And what would happen is I would go down, I would scare the hell out of myself, come back, sit in a restaurant or a bar for a couple of days thinking about it. And then I got into this kind of, backwards and forwards thing where I always felt bad for not being there. But then when I got there, I felt scared, so I had to leave. So for a while, it kind of went like that a little bit.
Have you ever wanted to be a journalist?
No, I hadn't really thought of. I mean, I suppose I did somewhere deep down. It's not in my background. Nobody in my family has ever been a journalist. But in 1989, I was in Transylvania when the revolution started, when the revolution against Ceausescu started. And I left. It was a similar kind of thing. I left just before the shooting started, really. There was shooting already in Timișoara, in Temeșvar, but not where I was. And I left, and as soon as I'd left, I thought, oh, I should have stayed. So I filled up my car with aid and medical supplies and went back. So already then, I did have some kind of attraction to it. And I think writing was probably always going to be the way I was going to go rather than being an aid worker or something. But I hadn't formulated it very well. And I didn't think of myself certainly as a journalist at that point.
Yeah, but finally you didn't stop. And maybe this, you know, first adrenaline shock or your vocation, probably your future vocation won you over. And you could overcome your fear and started traveling to Africa to see you were in Sierra Leone, then in certain Middle Eastern countries. What brought you there exactly? Oh, it was obvious for you after the Balkans that you start traveling and covering conflict zones.
You know, I was in the Balkans for almost 10 years. I was there really, I mean, at the beginning, between, say, 1991 and 1995, it was patchy. I would go there and come back and go there and come back. But from 1995, I was offered a full-time job by the Daily Telegraph, living in Sarajevo, there, right at the end of the war. But it was still, there was still quite a lot of conflict going on. And then when the Kosovo War started in 1998, I did that full-time. So I was in Kosovo for nearly 2 years, pretty much continuously. And by then, yeah, I'd been sort of tagged, I suppose, as a war reporter. There's a little, it's a bit tricky, the term war reporter, because really it should apply to people who only cover wars. And there are very, very few people who only cover wars. I mean, in the whole of Britain, I can think of one who only ever covers wars. He's a friend of mine. So most people, they're reluctant to use the word war reporter because they do other stuff as well. And I did other stuff as well, but I did mostly war. So I kind of got into that niche. And so, for example, with Sierra Leone, obviously it was something I didn't know anything about. I was actually in Bosnia. There was a funny story behind the Sierra Leone deployment. My brother was there. He was working for the British government as an aid worker, and he was taken hostage. And so I really wanted to get there. And I had this crazy idea that I could somehow buy him out, take a load of money and get him out somehow. But I didn't tell that to the newspaper because I knew they wouldn't let me go if I told them. So I called them up, which was a bit underhanded of me, but I called them up and I said, look, that guy you've got there right now, he's a bit useless. You know, I'm reading his stuff. It's terrible. You need a proper journalist there. He's a friend of mine. And I told him later. I didn't tell him at the time. So eventually, they didn't really understand why I was so insistent, but they did send me. But you know, every war is different, and it's an arrogance to think that because you've covered one war, you understand the nature of another war. It's just not true. You may have some skills, and they may or may not be applicable, but they can also be very dangerous. And the day I flew into Sierra Leone, I was in Budapest, I flew to London, I got on a military flight to Sierra Leone, British military flight. And that day, a friend of mine was killed in Sierra Leone. And I'm not saying it was his fault or anything like that, but he had also covered the Balkans. And I think as former Balkan war correspondents, we had a certain expectation going into these places, and it just was not the case in Sierra Leone. It was extremely randomly violent. There was no real rationale to anything. You could die just because something went slightly wrong. So it wasn't anything like later what became in Iraq, for example, where, you know, Al-Qaeda were looking for journalists and trying to find journalists to take hostage. It was far less thought out than that, but it was still nevertheless dangerous. So I found Sierra Leone difficult. It was very, very hot. It was very humid. I just didn't feel comfortable in the jungle. I can't explain why. It's something to do with the physiology of it, I think. And I found it a very difficult place to work in. Another thing I found in Sierra Leone, and this is a big divider in my wars I like to cover and wars I don't, is that I could not fade into the background in Sierra Leone. The mere fact that I was white and obviously from a foreign country meant everywhere I went, I was
obviously a soldier or a journalist.
Exactly. Yeah. And as soon as I went somewhere, they'd react. Everybody would stop what they were doing and react to me. And I found that very difficult. Whereas in Russia, you could just about get away with being a Russian. It was tricky. You didn't look like a Russian necessarily, but you could probably get away with it. So I think I just got pigeonholed in the end. And I remember one day an editor calling me up and saying, you know, we've got a slow news day. There's nothing happening. We need something for the newspaper. And I said, well, there's nothing happening here either. And he said to me, yeah, but Julius, you know, couldn't you just go out and, I don't know, get winged or something, and he was
going to just go out and exist out there. So the public.
I think he looked upon me as a sort of a pheasant that he could just throw up and have a shot at, and then write a story about it. I don't know. Yeah, but there was a big division between the Balkans and the other wars that followed. And it became, I mean, the Balkans could be dangerous, certainly, but it became progressively more serious as time went on and harder to work.
Yes, and you already mentioned the changing nature of war, or how different can be two wars or conflicts in different continents, especially now we can say between the 20th and the 21st century,
mm-hmm.
how artificial intelligence and all these kind of new initiatives somehow rewrite the nature of war as well as every other aspect of our lives. And I also wanted to touch upon this, and I wanted to begin with this, actually, that we talk a little bit about the term, how we define war or conflict, because as you're someone who has seen and experienced situations, events, or even tragedies, which are for the majority are, you know, mostly short news or tweets. And for this, I think it's a must to clarify what are we actually talking about. And I would like to quote a Prussian military leader, military theorist, who you may know, Karl von Clausewitz, who said that war is a continuation of politics with other means. So this is a pretty theoretical quote, but I would like you to reflect somehow to it. How did you see war? What is a war in your eyes?
It's a really good question. I mean, I think, first of all, people think that wars just happen, and they don't. It takes a lot to make a war happen. It takes a lot of preparation. It takes a lot of forethought. You've got to get the guns into the hands of the right people. There has to be the political situation that allows you to declare war. You have to have some kind of popular support.
You need to have the money to buy those guns.
You need to have the money. You need to have all kinds of motivation. You need to prepare the ground. Maybe a classic case is the 1980s in Yugoslavia, the way that Milosevic slowly prepared people for war. But it didn't happen in a week or a month. It took several years. It doesn't always take several years. And then, yeah, once war happens, I mean, it's very interesting because today we do have this thought that as soon as a war breaks out, we should end it. It's a general sort of 21st century thing. Wars are bad. Stop them. Get everybody to negotiate, regardless of what the negotiation looks like afterwards. And I'm not against that idea, but there's a reason that those wars exist in the first place, some kind of reason. Bosnia is an example of a war that was stopped. I'm not saying it was stopped prematurely, because I'm not in favor of any kind of killing. How could I be? But it was stopped in a way that it was unresolved. And you can still see the results of that today, whatever it is, 25 years later. So what is war like? Yeah, I mean, there's another thing that comes to me, and this is a very unfashionable thing to say, but war is very, very exciting. It's something that people don't talk about much, because we live in an age where everybody wants to talk about, you know, how terrible things are and how offended and victimized they feel by everything. But the fact is, the reality is, for a 19-year-old British man coming from an industrial city, being given some of the best equipment in the world, going off to a place like Afghanistan, which is highly exotic, with his friends or people who soon become his friends, and effectively going hunting, but hunting for other people, and the price is his own potential death, is a hugely exciting thing. And we forget this, or we don't talk about it, or we don't want to talk about it. And it's one of the reasons why soldiers have such incredible problems when they go back home again. It's not just that they're damaged by war. It's that they've found something out there that is more meaningful than anything they'll ever have again. And they suffer because of that. And as a war correspondent, I have to say I have similar feelings towards war. There's a great quote.
Even today.
I mean, I'm getting old now and, you know, time goes by. But I read a great quote the other day, and I can't remember it word for word, but it was an American Civil War leader, and I think he said something like, it's a good thing that war is so brutal and so grim and so miserable, otherwise we'd want to do it all the time. And it does have that strange attraction. Now, for me, not as a combatant, but as a correspondent, it is some of the most exciting things you'll ever do in your life.
Maybe if you look at it from another perspective, as you mentioned Sierra Leone, war can be, I don't know if you agree with this, a great way to skip from reality for certain people. So if you have the guns, if you start a war and you have like poverty and an ongoing conflict around you, it's also like, you know, an exit from reality if you like.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you know, it's exciting, much as we don't want to admit that. It's tribal. It's not that different a feeling than going to a football ground on a Saturday afternoon with three pints of beer in you and hanging out with your best friends and getting all upset with the guys on the other side of the field. And, you know, if you meet them outside, maybe you fight them, maybe you don't. But that feeling of sort of, you know, intense, passionate tribalism, it does something, maybe it does lift people out of...
It's not as predictable as a small English town, for instance.
Yes, it's not as predictable. And, I mean, of course, what happens is as soon as you engage in it in a meaningful way, you come across the other side as well, which is the horror and the pain and the suffering and the filth and the needlessness of it. So you experience both sides extremely intensely, I would say. Nobody I know who spent a huge amount of time in war comes out being a fan of war, but the more honest of them will accept that it's probably the most intense, meaningful thing they've lived through, or one of the most intense, meaningful things they've lived through in their lives.
Yes, and I think we're slowly but surely arriving to the title of this podcast, which is the ethics of war journalism, or war reporting, or conflict correspondence. Now I would like to quote Robert Capa, the Hungarian-American world-famous photographer, who once said, it's almost a cliche now, that if your pictures aren't good enough, you aren't close enough.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that? And how would you react to this quote as someone whose job was basically to be close as possible?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, first of all, Capa was a photographer. And for a photographer, you really do have to be close. As a writer, you don't have to be so close. But it helps. It helps.
You have to be there.
You have to be there. You can't be 10 miles away in a hotel, and you can't be, because whatever you think you're going to find on the front line, you never quite find it. You always find something slightly different, sometimes something very different. But without actually going there, you don't know exactly what you're going to find. And for me, I mean, the most compelling thing about covering war was always, it was always to do with humanity. It was never to do with politics, really. It was always to do with humanity and that interaction of humanity. And in order to see that and feel that, you have to be there. So there's something in what Capa says. Being close. You also have to learn to manage yourself, though, and it takes... You have to sort of manage yourself psychologically. You have to manage yourself in terms of danger as well. And, you know, you want to have risk mitigation strategies in place. That's a fancy way of basically saying you want to look after yourself a bit. But you also need to pace yourself a little bit psychologically and emotionally. And I think that comes with time. I really pushed myself for a long time. And in the end, I got post-traumatic stress disorder. And it was actually in Sierra Leone that it hit me. I don't think it came because of Sierra Leone. I think it was accumulative, but it just absolutely took me down overnight. And it was a good year or two before I was kind of functional again. And it took a while to build up. And now I could still do it. I went back to Afghanistan with the U.S. Marines a few years ago. I can do it, but I'm older and wiser, and I understand the processes a bit better.
Have you managed to be once too close? Or is it possible to be too close? Or is there, that does exist a sort of moral code for war zone correspondents, or rules that you have to...
There are some rules, but the real sort of morality of it is not in the rules. I mean, one rule is that you shouldn't carry a weapon, because if you do carry a weapon, then you're not just endangering yourself or your people who are with you, you're endangering any correspondent in any situation. Now, that said, it's very hypocritical of me, because I have carried a weapon once in a war zone. It was just so incredibly dangerous, I didn't feel... I could do without it. In retrospect, it was probably a mistake. I probably shouldn't have. I certainly didn't shoot anybody or shoot at anybody, but I did have one. But so that's a rule that I guess I broke. The big things around ethics, though, come down to there's a mistake amongst journalists that they think that you should be neutral. It's neutrality is not something to aspire to. I mean, if you were in Auschwitz at the end of 1944, when the Soviets showed up, as a journalist, your job would not have been to say, well, the Germans say this and the Jews say this, and there you go. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle. Your job is to find out what actually happened. So it's to be fair. It's about being fair and being honest, even when maybe you find something you don't like that doesn't fit in with your worldview. You have an absolute requirement to report it. But there's so many ethical issues. And you know, you're surrounded by children and women and people who are suffering and people who are getting hurt and people who are getting killed. And you're a human being. You want to do things. You want to intervene. You want to help them. And you have to balance that against the effect that it's going to have on not just you, but other journalists if you start getting too involved.
Yeah, that would be my next question, actually, that if you're on a battlefield and you see civilians suffering, injustice and all these kind of things for a long period of time, somehow, because we're all humans, it's absolutely understandable that you somehow want to intervene in your way. You want to choose a side. You want to also become some sort of representative of a certain group of people who are suffering maybe the most in that certain conflict. So is that something that you have to, that you don't have to follow? In this,
yeah, you have to fight against it. I mean,
this feeling.
There's you know, a very, very good example. The close friend of mine, Mark Franchetti, he went into Iraq in 2003 with the U.S. Marines, with the U.S. Army or the Marines. No, the Marines. And they were involved in a battle. They were young guys. They didn't have much experience of war. There was a battle. And he was embedded with them. Now, the reason the American government embedded journalists was because they knew that they would get favorable coverage out of it. Because if you stick someone in an APC or a tank or whatever with a bunch of soldiers for 3 weeks, they're going to bond. And when people fire at you, you're going to tend to favor the people that are around you. And in this particular incident, and it was a particular incident, I'm not saying this is general, the U.S. Marines ended up shooting a lot of civilians, not because they were angry, but because they were scared, I think. And Franchetti, who's a very, very experienced war correspondent, just reported it as it was. And that was his job. He didn't have a duty to the U.S. Marines. He had a duty to the truth. Did he want to do that? He probably didn't, but you just have to. So you have to try and separate out your emotions. And people try and manipulate you, especially if your own country is involved. I mean, I had my newspaper call me up from London when I was in Iraq. And I went into fight with the Shia militias against the Americans, which I probably shouldn't have done, not because it was unethical, it was just bloody dangerous. And they said, you're not being patriotic in your coverage. And I said, look, my job is not to be patriotic in my coverage. My job is to tell the truth and let readers decide. If I'm not telling the truth properly, I'll take the criticism, but don't tell me that I'm here as some kind of cheerleader for the British military. I'm not. That's not my job.
How different was your other job in the Russian capital of Moscow? Because later on you were appointed as correspondent of the British Telegraph to the Russian capital. And I read that you also reported from the Second Chechen War as well. But your job was mainly, as far as I understood, to report from Moscow.
Yes, it was a mixed job. So I was based in Moscow and I still did cover war. So I still went to Iraq, but it was mostly Moscow-based. I covered a tiny bit of the Second Chechen War. I love being in Moscow. I really like Russia. It's got its negatives, but I do really like the country. And I was very lucky to be there at a time where there's a huge amount of freedom. So I could do things you just couldn't do today. I went in.
It was in the beginning, I think, during the first presidency of Putin?
Yeah, 2002 to 2005, I was in Russia. So I went in undercover for 2 weeks in Chechnya with Spetsnaz. You couldn't do that today. They're too careful. They're too controlled. You know, I went to Chechnya. They got upset with me in Chechnya. The Russians kept saying, you can't do that. You can't do that. And finally, in the end, somebody opened fire on the car that had been sent to pick me up. And I think it was probably something to do with the Russian government, but I can't prove it. But you did have a lot of freedom to move around. And it was an interesting time as well. I also covered, I mean, there was the terrorist attack on the theater in Moscow in Nordost in 2002. I was caught up in that. Well, I was there when that happened, and then I was even more involved in the terrorist attack on the school in Russia in 2004 in Beslan, which was horrible. I mean, there's just 170 dead children. Is just absolutely, there's no way to explain it, and it had a serious effect on me for quite a while afterwards.
Later on, just one day, Julius Strauss woke up and said that, okay, I'm done here. I'm moving to Canada to open a ranch for grizzly bears. Oh, how did that happen, actually?
Kind of. I mean, what happened? A few things came together. One was Beslan. The second was I just met, I'd been divorced, and I just met a woman I cared a lot for. And I knew after my first marriage that, you know, being a war correspondent and being married at the same time, it's pretty difficult. It's hard on your family. And the other thing was I realized that I'd had the end of the golden age of the foreign correspondent. The money was going, advertising was going, newspapers were suffering. And I could have carried on, I think. I mean, I was good enough to carry on for quite a long time, but it would never have been quite as good. I would never have had that kind of freedom.
Is it because of the social media and Twitter and the, like, this boom of local sources or the local availability?
Initially, it was because classified advertising fell apart. It just disappeared overnight. And the newspaper I worked for, and most newspapers, depended heavily for their income on classified advertising. And that just went. We've been through a very difficult 10 or 15 years in the media with not much money, everything getting squeezed, things becoming lower quality. Hopefully now we're beginning to turn a corner. There are some business models out there that seem to work. But that's not really my area of expertise. But I was very lucky. I was very lucky to have the freedom I had. It was a fantastic job. I mean, if I did it all again, I think I would do more or less the same thing again.
Yes, but let's get back to the bears.
Yeah.
So you moved to British Columbia.
Yes.
Opened a ranch.
Yes.
And recently you just published a fascinating article in our knowledge base at Corvinak.edu about an AI facial recognition system for grizzly bears.
Yes.
To which you have contributed to in a ways.
Yeah.
With your project. So how can we imagine a war correspondent after, I don't know, 15, 20 years of professional service in British Columbia among the icy but beautiful Canadian mountains? How do your average day look like now? How does your average day look like these years?
I mean, it's kind of what you would imagine. It's going out for long periods of time on foot, sometimes on my own. I have a dog that I've trained to use her nose. She's quite useful, so I usually take her. Sometimes I take guests. Sometimes I just go out to spot. And yeah, you're right. It's a little business. I mean, it's very, very, very different. And what I realized when I got there is none of the skills I had as a war correspondent really helped me sitting in the wilderness in Canada. But, you know, at the end of the day, and I mean, this took years and years to understand, but really, you know, life is about facing down your fears. It's about facing up to adversity. It's about building some kind of resilience in yourself, whatever that means. And in that sense, the two were similar. They were both things that I wasn't good at when I started, and I just had to keep trying and trying and trying to get some kind of results. And now, yes, so about 10 or 20% of the business, we try and put into some kind of conservation initiative. The facial recognition software is one. We've also had a campaign to try and stop some trophy hunting of grizzly bears. We help the locals. We buy pepper spray and electric fencing to try and reduce conflict with bears. And then my latest thing, which kind of combines the two, is I've got some grant money from the Royal Foundation in the UK, which is Prince William's Foundation, to bring veterans, British Army veterans with PTSD over to Canada and take them out into nature. And what I don't want to do, and I feel very strongly about this, I don't want to treat them like victims and try and fix them and help them and cure them, because I just don't believe in that process. What I want to do is to offer them a place that can bring out of them the skills and the knowledge and the experience that they actually have inside them and use it for something useful. In the first instance, to train us, to train me and my guides, but ultimately as a way to bring them back from the dark places that they're in and give them a useful role in life, probably outside the military setting.
Is there some correlation in this, what I'm just about to say, that maybe after many years, when you have seen, you know, the dark side of humanity, conflicts and wars, you really longed for beauty?
Yes, I think so. I mean, yes. And also, you know, I'm a bit naive and a bit idealistic. And somehow I had this notion that, you know, people in Canada, they're just better people. They're more peaceful. They don't fight each other the whole time. But of course, what you realize is that people are people. Human nature is human nature everywhere you go. And, you know, what a lot of people forget is that in wars, you see some terrible things, but you also see some incredible things. You see incredible generosity and self-sacrifice and some very, very positive sides of human nature and very negative sides. And in Canada, you see the positive sides. People are peaceful. They kind of get on with each other. But there are the negative sides as well. And it shouldn't have really come as a surprise. So, yes, you can't get away from human nature. You can't get away from politics. Even in the middle of the British Columbia bush, you are affected by politics. And ultimately, that was why I decided to, you know, dig out my old jacket and head off to the government of British Columbia and start lobbying for things that I believe in, because that was the only way to change things.
Finally, I would like to ask you a little bit about your Hungarian roots. How do you see Hungary? Because your father has Hungarian roots. So if you can a little bit talk about this as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I'm part Hungarian. I have Hungarian citizenship. I speak Hungarian, not as well as you do, but I do speak some Hungarian. I feel very comfortable. I feel very comfortable in Hungary. I mean, one thing I really like about being in this part of the world is that the new world is wonderful in many ways. It's so optimistic. It's so naively optimistic. But, you know, here in this part of Europe, we know that you don't really get to control your own fate. I mean, once every now and then, you know, whether it's the guys to the east or the guys to the west decide they're going to march all over you, and that's just what happens because, you know, it's a small country and we don't really get to choose these kind of things. But what we do get to do, and this is a very important thing for me, and it's very close to me, is that even though you don't get to decide those things, you do get to decide how you react to it and how you behave with that in a moral sense. And there's an understanding, I think, in this part of the world of those nuances that come with that, which there isn't in the new world so much. And so I'm really enjoying my time here. It's nice to be back. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Julius, for being here with us. And I'm really looking forward to welcoming you here once again in the future when you return to Hungary, probably next year. We'll talk about it for sure. And I'm also really looking forward, I think I'm not alone with it, to reading some memoirs in the future. I don't know if you ever thought about that.
I have thought about it. And I am working on something. It's difficult to write. I'm a trained journalist and it's difficult to write very personally about yourself. But I'm going through the process and hopefully something will come out the end eventually.
We are looking forward to it. Thank you very much again.
Thank you, Peter. Nice to talk to you.
In this podcast, my guest was Julius Strauss, journalist, former war correspondent to The Telegraph and many other newspapers, and a devout environmentalist, owner of a grizzly bear ranch in British Columbia. My name is Peter Haltai, and this was an episode of MCC Podcast.
Thank you for listening to this MCC Podcast episode. For further media content, please look up our English website at mcc.hu/en or look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you want to read more by our professors, external contributors, and students, check out our knowledge base at corvinec.hu/en.